another episode of the Sorum Chatter podcast. I'm Nachi Weinstein. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by the BMAC family in honor and an appreciation of the Sorum Chatter podcast. This episode is also sponsored by Mosaica Press. Here's something you won't want to miss, a publishing powerhouse known for its dedication to excellence, preserving, and sharing wisdom. We're spotlighting a publisher that's uniting the brightest minds in the Jewish community. Their books go beyond the ordinary, they're conversation starters, bridging gaps around the globe, and even in our own communities. Now here's the deal that's grabbing attention. Order three or more of their thought-provoking books and they'll add a free gift to your order. That's right, a little extra something for you, the discerning reader. If you're ready to explore, visit mosaicapress.com, which is mosaicapress.com. And don't forget to use the code CHATTER, CHATTER, to get 15% off. And the links and information is in the show's notes. I also want to give a programming update and a disclaimer. This episode, as I mentioned last week, we'll start turning towards Pesach-related content. This is about blood libel. Then there'll be one about the history of Choreses, as well as something on the Haggadah. If anyone would like to sponsor any of these episodes, or if you have, or any other episode, or if you have any additional ideas about the, to do a Pesach-related episode, please email me, sfarmchatter@gmail.com, or see the links and information in the show's notes below. Also, I would like to give a disclaimer before this episode. This episode is about blood libels, specifically later blood libels, the end of the turn of the century, from the 1800s to the 1900s, so 19th to 20th centuries. And yes, there unfortunately were blood libels and things very late. Obviously, the Dreyfus Affair is known, but this is some other ones that aren't as well known. But it is appropriate this is being aired on Easter, about the blood libels and ritual murder accusations, which happened to the Jews, unfortunately, at this time of year over the centuries. But there is some gruesome depictions of murder and the like in these that arose from these individual cases and the murder trials that followed from these murders. So just a heads up that it's a little bit, there is graphic and gruesome the book is, and some of the podcast is, unfortunately, obviously. As I said, to sponsor an episode or support the podcast, you can check out the links and information in the show's notes below. You can subscribe and check out the Sfarim Chatter YouTube channel. The link and information is in the show's notes below. Also for the Substack, which is like a blog, the link in the show's notes. Also for the Sfarim Chatter WhatsApp community, which is like the Twitter X, where I post the links and information about new Sfarim and books, as well as you can please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen. And whether that's Apple, if you do, you can over there, you can subscribe. You can rate and review the podcast if you can. Appreciate it. And Spotify and 24/6, which now has CarPlay and Android Auto, which is, you know, great product. So with that, here's the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I will be joined by Professor Hillel Kival, who is the Gloria M. Goldstein Professor Emeritus of Jewish History and Thought at Washington University in St. Louis. And we'll be discussing his new book titled Blood Inscriptions, Science, Modernity, and Ritual Murder at Europe's Turn of the Century. I'll let Professor Kival say the French word, because I'm going to totally, just absolutely butcher the pronunciation of that. But anyway, and this is about blood libel, the blood libel, especially at the late 19th and early 20th centuries, taking place in Hungary, Germany, Austria, Czech Republic, all that area. So thank you, Professor Kival, for joining me.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, let's see. I'm a historian of European Jews from roughly Haskalah to Shoah. And I grew up in the Boston area and did both my undergraduate and graduate studies at Harvard, working largely with Yosef Yerushalmi, the late Yosef Yerushalmi, also with a number of European historians for a period with Isidore Tursky as well. And growing up in the Boston area, I did not go to day schools, but I had intensive Hebrew education, which at the in those days one could have 10 hours a week of Hebrew. I also studied at the Boston Hebrew College in their prose door and Hebrew speaking camps, Machane Yavne. So I had a real Hebraic kind of upbringing. And began my teaching career at the University of Washington in Seattle. A stint at Brandeis, and now it's been 24 years in St. Louis at Washington University.
So how did you become interested in this topic, specifically these blood libels? But it's not all blood libels. It's really very late blood libels.
Right. And especially those that made it to trial, and which is different. I wasn't only interested in beliefs, popular beliefs, accusations that made through megaphones, you know, or in the daily press. But I was especially interested in those points in time, paradoxically, around 1900, when states in Central Europe decided to grant some kind of plausibility and legitimacy to certain accusations of Jewish ritual murder. So if we back up a little bit, I got interested in this originally as part of my general interest in Jewish modernization and cultural change and collective identity, especially in Central Europe and in urban settings of Central Europe. So think Vienna and Berlin and Prague and Budapest. And one of the, in my first two books, my first two books dealt with Jews in the Czech lands, the Bohemian lands, and the ways in which national controversies between Czechs and Germans, for example, affected the way Jews imagined themselves, affected the way they behaved, affected the languages they chose to speak, affected the ways in which they affected whom they wished to identify with collectively, and of course, even helped to promote Jewish nationalism and a cultural Zionism among students and academics. But in the course of that research and writing, especially in the first book, The Making of Czech Jewry, one of the events that rises to the surface very clearly in the late 1890s and early 20th century involved what we now call the Hilsner affair, which was an accusation of ritual murder against a somewhat marginal, unemployed Jewish shoemaker in the Bohemian town of Polna against a 19-year-old Christian woman, which was a cause célèbre. It was as famous in Central Europe as was the Dreyfus affair in France, for example, and essentially almost simultaneous to the Dreyfus affair, at least the appeals and retrials of Alfred Dreyfus. So I wrote about it very briefly in The Making of Czech Jewry, since it was related to radical Czech nationalism, and it seemed to put up a roadblock at the time to the acceptability or advisability of Jewish identification with Czechs over Germans. But that was it, right? And I attributed it, as most historians had up to the time, to the tenacity of superstition and myth and irrationality in the modern world. In other words, one of the ways of resisting modernity was to claim that irrationality is just as important as rationality in modern identity formation and organization. So the Hilsner affair was sort of the medieval myth and superstition raising its ugly head inappropriately and way too late, right? Perhaps it was one of those examples that showed that we shouldn't presume that modernity that equals rationality equals reason equals scientific advance or whatever. Okay. So that was, I then put it to the side, and I always intended at some point to write a comparative study of this trial and others like it that were taking place around the same time, because it wasn't alone. It was preceded by two also very famous trials, one that took place in Hungary in the 1880s, involving a small village of Tiso-Eslar, in which not just one Jewish defendant was on trial, but 15 Jews were actually a good portion of the population of Tiso-Eslar, plus others in the vicinity, were all on trial for a murder, in this case of a 14-year-old Hungarian girl named Esther Schoimoshi. Then there was a German trial in the town of Xanten, then Hilsner, and then there was yet another one in another German city called Konitz in the eastern part of the German Empire in West Prussia. And everyone knows the most famous of them all, which I wasn't going to look at that closely, and that is the Bayliss case in Russia, 1911-1913, in Kiev, today's Ukraine. So I wanted to look at these trials, but I had to figure out what they had in common and how they, in the end, I wanted to ask, how did these things work? They shouldn't have worked. They shouldn't have worked for a number of reasons. One of which is that actually for a good 200 years, and in some places 300 years, since the Protestant Reformation in Western and Central Europe, since the 18th century in Poland, what became Poland, states refused to prosecute cases, with very few exceptions. They refused to prosecute cases of supposed Jewish ritual murder because they were relegated to the realm of superstition, irrationality, folk belief, what have you. But they were delegitimized by the state. And this was especially true after the European Enlightenment. So how is it then that in the post-Enlightenment, post-scientific age, prosecuting attorneys and ministries of justice and high courts decide to prosecute four or five very sensational trials that either make a direct appeal to the ritual murder accusation as the motive for the crime, or they imply that it was the motive for the crime. And then there's a third possibility, and that is that while the state may wish to sweep that under the rug because it's a little bit undignified, perhaps, in the Central European trials, the victim's family often had an attorney present at trial who had the right to cross-examine witnesses and to speak to make a final summation to the jury, et cetera. And oftentimes, these victims' attorneys, if the state didn't want to bring up the ritual murder accusation, they used almost all of their airtime to bring it up. So that was the question. How does it work? Shouldn't work. It's out, as I write, it's out of place and it's out of time. And this is actually, I think, an important question, because if we simply want to relegate it to the ridiculous, the nonsense, the nonsensical, it's just another example of Goyim hating Jews, right? Then we're not really going to understand it, and we're not going to know how it works, and we're not going to be able to follow the intricate paths that conspiracy theories and other kinds of prejudicial accusations work, even in today's world. Okay, so that was the question. That's the big question. How does these things even work? And what I found was, in all of these cases, that they cannot simply reproduce the kinds of language and methods that were part of the, let's call it, the pre-modern ritual murder accusation, which we can talk about if you want, the medieval and early modern accusations, which are very rather famous, which have they work according to a whole different kind of rationale. Here, in fact, it was actually scientific language, scientific procedures, forensic medicine, the kinds of things that we're used to seeing on television programs today, which did create a, let's call it a disciplinary structure that that all sides in this in these trials took for granted or accepted. They accepted the this kind of discipline and the discipline of scientific language and procedures in order to make their case. So they couldn't say things like, "Oh yeah, sure. Maybe we can't prove what happened using using forensic procedures by blood analysis and crime scene investigations and autopsies and things like that. But you're going to have to take our word for it that this is what Jews do and this is why they do it." No, they, in fact, they did just the opposite. Everyone worked within those generally accepted limitations and disciplinary structures. And that's why I say science, modernity, and ritual murder at Europe's fin de siècle, because one tended to give deference to academic and scientific authority, unlike today, and to accept their to accept that authority, and that meant that all of these cases could only work for as long as they did work, if they worked under those conditions. And then I look at how they, the various struggles that take place in these various towns and in these cases, conflicts over evidence, over science, over things like motive, witness testimony, that kind of a thing. And then ultimately, why, as I say, these trials had a shelf life of about 30 years. And then they collapse. And they collapse, I think, for a variety of reasons, one of which is that they're never uncontested, right? They're always contested. And ultimately, those very same scientific, that same scientific scaffolding on which they rest crumbles, or it actually subverts the arguments. So that's the broad outline. So I think that they need to, and that meant that I argue that these have to be looked at not as anti-modern phenomena, not as resistance to the modern world, but as modern phenomena. And hence, very different from the medieval accusation.
So let's just talk about the medieval accusation for a minute. At least as it pertains to here, we're not going to go into a full length, you know, sure, background of the blood libel. That's not what the book is out to do. But just, you know, as it pertains to here, I mean, there's blood libels all over Europe. Throw out, you know, the famous, you know, interestingly, and we'll get to Trump in a second. First, just how the blood libel worked, I guess, medieval times, and how that differs, as you say, from here. Mm-hmm.
So there, let's see. There are three classical accusations, actually, in the medieval world against Jews that are all related. One of which we might call the ritual murder accusation, and the famous case of William of Norwich is a classic example of that. That was in the mid 12th century England, followed by a couple of other cases like Hugh of Lincoln, which is mid 13th century England. But in that accusation, Jews are understood to kidnap young Christian male children, and to reenact a kind of crucifixion ceremony. So they feel compelled through evil intent and hostility and vengeance to reenact the same crucifixion that Jews were accused of having perpetrated 2,000 years or in this case, 1,100 years earlier. That's the ritual murder accusation proper. There is a second accusation, which is the desecration of the host accusation. It's related because here the claim is that Jews and other malfeasants were eager to acquire consecrated wafers, consecrated hosts, in order to enact violence on them, to pierce them with swords or pins, to burn them in order to cause suffering to what the church at the time, and here we're in the 13th and 14th, especially the 14th century, which the church understood to be the quote real body of Christ. And the last one is related to both, but especially to the first, and that's the so-called blood libel, in which Jews not only wish to crucify and torture the representations of Christ-like figures in the Christian community, but they do it specifically in order to ingest and make use of the blood of their victims. Now, I know that these are all rather gruesome and grotesque kinds of and cruel accusations, but I think that one can begin to understand how they work by looking at Christian self-understanding at the time and their understand also related to their understanding of how the Eucharistic service worked and what happened in that service. I bring that up because what gives coherence to all of these accusations is the fact that believing Christians felt that they were in fact ingesting the body of Christ, and that moreover that the elements, the Eucharistic elements, became at the moment of consecration real things, right? So they became the real body of Jesus, the blood of Jesus. And the reason that you could ask, well, okay, but what would motivate Jews in their own view? What would motivate Jews to do harm to those elements? And so here, I guess, there are two arguments that one could make. And one would be that Jews are disposed to harm those elements because they had hatred of Christianity, they had hatred of their Christian neighbors, and they wished to do harm to the Christian divinity. But even more intimately connected here is the fact that in engaging in these kinds of violent, symbolically violent behaviors, Jews would be maybe unknowingly attesting to the truth of Christian doctrine, especially the very controversial doctrine at the time of transubstantiation. And that was the doctrine that said that that these Eucharistic elements become in some kind of real sense, in quotation marks, the body and blood of Christ. So Jews, if Jews are actually, if they know that that doctrine is true, and they're acting in a negative way against the Eucharistic elements, well, it's clearly true, right? They're Jews, the unbelievers are proving the truth of Christian doctrine. You can see how different that is from the mindset of the turn of the 20th century.
So how does it differ when you come to these trials you're saying it does differ. Now, also, I want to also clarify something. So here, these are ritual murder accusations or blood libel? Blood libel, I guess what you're saying is kind of what everyone's familiar with. They took the blood and they mixed it in the matzah.
Yeah, well, that's right. And by the way, in the medieval world or the medieval accusation, the blood libel, there were a variety of theories as to why Jews, what use Jews put the blood. We're used to thinking that it was always universally assumed to be that they used the blood to prepare matzah on Passover. But in fact, there were a variety of reasons. One was that, some of them are quite weird, I have to tell you, but one of them was that blood was used in powdered form to staunch the bleeding from circumcision. Another one, which is really weird, is that Jewish males menstruated and that they needed the blood from the Eucharistic elements in order to stop the male menstruation. Okay, so clearly these are all forms of the majority Christian world wondering about the world and wondering about themselves. Your question again was that are these blood libels? Yes. Okay. And so by the time you get to the 14th or 15th century, the matzah blood libel has won out. That's the one that everyone simply presumes. And there's a very good reason for that too, right? Because if the Christians know that their unleavened bread that they consume at Mass contains the body and blood of Christ, then it makes perfect sense for them to imagine that Jews engage in a kind of mirroring practice in their own unleavened bread. They also use blood. They want to use the body, the blood of Christ as an ingredient. So that, in other words, it confirms again the sanctity and the Christian understanding of their own Eucharistic elements. Okay, so we do see that in the other cases. For example, the prosecuting attorneys and their police investigators, if they want to use scientific methods in order to prove that these crimes in question involved ritual murder, they're interested in questions of blood. They're interested in questions like how much blood was found at the scene of the crime? How much blood was found in the body at the time? How much blood does a normal body contain? The body seems to have lost a lot of blood, or as they liked to say, I'm talking about prosecutors now, it was, quote, drained of blood, unquote. Or if the surrounding area didn't seem not to have sufficient blood to account for how much would normally be in the body, then the question that the prosecutors often liked to raise was, where did it go? What became of the blood? Now, it's not always so mysterious. So oftentimes, certain detectives and investigators would say, well, it means that the crime was committed somewhere else and the body was moved. And so where the body was moved, we don't have a lot of blood. That sounds very modern, right? Very contemporary. Or you could have competing interpretations of the crime scene where one police report would say, and actually not just police, but forensic physicians who are engaged in examining the body and conducting autopsies, they might say, well, it's nonsense that that there wasn't enough blood at the scene of the crime to account for how much a body actually takes. There's so much splatter all over the place that clearly there was enough. So there's contest going on here, but the echoes of the traditional blood libel are certainly there. It's just that it's not mystified as such. I'm going to prove it to you scientifically. That's what they would say.
Yeah, and that's what really is very interesting. And we're going to get into some of, you know, these cases, because they're really, I mean, I was telling you this before that, you know, not to put down the introduction and the first chapter, which is like the background, but I kind of skimmed those and I went on to the other chapters, the rest of the book, the other, yeah. I don't know, 150 page papers, and it was like a page turner. It's like a thriller. It's like really courtroom drama. There's mystery. It's just, unfortunately, it's really fascinating. And so, but one other thing I think to just, you know, emphasize before we go there is, you know, these are trials. You know, for example, yeah. Simon of Trent in 1475 in Italy, yeah, there was some sort of claim trial. You know, baloney, it wasn't a trial. This is like, that's a real sham. This is, okay, maybe this is also, but this is, these are like you're saying, there's a prosecution, there's lawyers, there's judges, there's witnesses. This is like some sort of trial, there's forensics. And there's, you know, okay, there are actually some kind of riots, pogroms, but back then it was no real trial, it was just pogroms and rioting and kill the Jews, as opposed to this is like cloaked in this kind of like modern, no, it's science, we're going to have a real trial and we're going to actually find someone, you know, we're going to actually find someone guilty and sentence them to death because of ritual murder. Ridiculous.
Yeah, this is, you know, you're totally right here that, it's important to establish a couple of distinctions. One is that sometimes if you look at the medieval and early modern cases, investigations, one is looking for a trial. They say they're trials. One's looking for a trial and we can't find a trial because the methods in the late medieval world were inquisitorial. So what basically the investigation and the interrogations of the examiners, the inquisitors, that is the trial. It's both examination and trial. And also, and the second important difference is that many of the punishments and executions followed confessions by the accused, but those confessions were arrived at almost always through torture. There was a debate in the late medieval world about the value of torture. Is torture unreliable because people want to, they just want it to be over with and they'll say anything so that the torture will stop? Or is torture, there is a legal theory in the pre-modern world that the only way you get criminals to actually confess, is through torture. Now, the use of torture to extract confessions was no longer allowed in criminal proceedings. In fact, it would invalidate testimony. In Central Europe, like Austria, the Habsburg monarchy, and Germany in the 1760s, in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, in 1776, a very good year in American history, in 1776, so that by the end of the 18th century, can no longer have confession under torture. And if, like in the Hungarian case that I looked at, when some of the defendants accused the police and investigators of torturing them, those accusations are taken very seriously. Another important difference is that all of my trials follow periods of judicial reform. So modern criminal codes, modern rules of procedure that, as you suggest, that's right. You have, so there are rules of criminal procedure. There are trials either by judge panels, judicial panels, or by juries. Another important distinction is that in the modern trials, the accused have the right to confront their accusers. So they can challenge testimony. And as we mentioned, we were talking together that it, sometimes these challenges of testimony from the accusers can be very dramatic, like in the Hungarian case, where one of the prize witnesses of the state was a 13-year-old son of the shamash of the synagogue, and he was challenged not only by some of the other accused but also directly by his father, with very long and dramatic back and forth between the son and the father in these testimonies. So yes, they're very different.
Yes, I think we should start. I think we should go through some of these cases. And obviously, we're not going to cover, you know, everything. And
sure.
Reading it especially, it's really dramatic. But I think we should start with that, with Hungarian Tiszeszlár affair and the accusation there. I think, you know, what happens, and then kind of the accusations and the trial.
Right. So this involves, this is in a village in Hungary. At that time, it was more or less central Hungary. The size of the Hungarian state has shrunk since 1918, and so it's now in more eastern Hungary than central. It would be a mistake to conclude from Tiszeszlár that all of these cases take place in very small villages. This is the only village trial. All the others are towns. Small to medium-sized towns. So the urban setting is actually still there, or is there. Now, in the Tiszeszlár case, it's got some aspects of the traditional pre-modern trial in that it seems like every Jew in the village is on trial, right? It's not just one individual who committed a murder, but everybody. So there were 15 Jewish males in the end who were tried. There were women who were arrested and interrogated in prison for a period of time, but only the Jewish males were on trial. They ranged from the shamash, Yakub Sharf, of the village, and also, they had the weekend that the victim disappeared, there was an audition and interviewing of three candidates to be the shochet and the sort of shochet and bal kore of the Tiszeszlár synagogue. And they had the bad fortune of being there on that weekend. So they were all put on trial. And there was also, this was a case where this young servant girl had disappeared, and there was no body. One could not find a body until about, I don't remember now exactly, it was over 3 months or almost about 3 months after the disappearance, a group of raftsmen who had been floating down the Tisza River. It was a group made up of Jews and non-Jews, of Hungarians and Ruthenians and Slovaks and others. They were on their rafts. You know, they were taking logs down the river. And the way they did that was they would tie them together, and they would basically be boats. So there were three rafts going down. And one of the rafts, when it was maybe 20 kilometers from Tiszeszlár, bumped into a body floating in the water. And so a lot then depended. There was so much at stake now in identifying who that body was, because if it was indeed Esther Shoymashi, remember that now that for over a month and a half or so, there's already an investigation. There's already a prosecutor. There's already a judge magistrate who's leading this investigation. So there's already a theory that somehow she has been done in by the Jews. And that meant that the identity of that corpse would be very important. She appeared to be wearing the clothing that Esther Shoymashi was wearing when she disappeared. It appeared to be a woman. Remember, this is a body that's been underwater for at least 6 weeks, if not longer. And it appeared that there were no wounds on this body, no marks of violence. So already boys were running up and down the river saying, hey, they found Esther, and the Jews didn't do it. And but the judge who was leading the investigation, it would be a district attorney or a prosecutor. But in the European case, the investigations were begun by judges, and then they were handed over to prosecutors. So this judge, whose name was Joseph Buddy, he was not happy with that kind of a testimony. And he was skeptical that, in fact, this was Esther Shoymashi. He was convinced that somehow the raftsmen and the Jews of Tisa Eslar had conspired to body switch and to place the body of a more mature, married Jewish woman, in the clothing of Esther Shoymashi. So this is a wild kind of a conspiracy theory, but it was important. It meant a number of things. A, that now all the Jewish raftsmen, originally everyone was like arrested and interrogated, but the Christian raftsmen more or less were released. The Jewish raftsmen were now part of this trial. So that ballooned now into 15 defendants. It meant that. But it also meant that everything depended, the state's case such as it was, depended on establishing scientifically the identity of the victim. And that's when we also get all sorts of wild theories, right? So the body had been underwater for more than a month now, right? Almost 2 months. And there are various different scientific processes. I won't go into their technical terms, but what they essentially end up doing is they remove the waves of water on the body over time, removes the hair and removes the outer layer of skin from the body. So it has this pinkish, very smooth, appearance. It removes the fingernails, and it seems to the untrained eye that these are actually nicely manicured nail beds, you know. And so the original forensic examination, at least as presented by this judge and the investigating judge and his physicians, said it looks like this is a woman who's not a peasant girl, and she's from a middle class background. She's older, and she follows the Orthodox Jewish custom of married women of shaving the head. So clearly it's a Jewish woman, right? This is an example of why a little bit of knowledge is sometimes worse than no knowledge whatsoever, right? And so you think you know your neighbors, you think you know their practices. This is what they do. So clearly it's a married woman. It's a married Jewish woman, right? Of course, she had no hair. She had no pubic hair. She had nothing. But they also said, and for reasons that are still somewhat obscure, that not only was she a 14-year-old virgin, but she had an inordinate amount or a large amount of sexual experience. It's really not clear exactly, but if you ask me, my intuition is that body parts are swollen, right? It's because the body is already rotting. And so gases inside the body are swelling, and it may be that they saw swollen organs, and that led them to say that. So you can see that though science is important, scientific methods at this point are a little bit iffy, and they're often not very good. They do get very good, though, as we get down. But again, you know, once the defense attorney and his team get involved, they successfully petition the court that the body needs to be exhumed because it was hastily buried. I mean, it sank to high heavens. The body needs to be exhumed and sent to the medical faculty in Budapest. So it's local science versus elite science, right? And we're going to send it now to the University in Budapest for confirmation. And but this was a real problem for the judge, because he sort of felt, you know, Budapest, lots of Jews in Budapest, you know, and they kind of you know, they accept the authority of Vienna, and we know the Vienna Medical School is just full of Jews. And so I'm not sure we can. So let's send it to some other medical establishment in Hungary, which they ended up doing. But the specialist, the Budapest specialist, nevertheless testified at trial. And they were very critical of the original scientific procedures and almost merciless in their attacks on that group. So the big question was this Esther? The quick answer is, in the end, the court said, we've got dueling scientists here. And so we'll say that we can't be established one way or another if the body is the body of Esther. That's not great news for the defendants. But what was more important was that the prize witness for the state was Moritz Scharf, who was the this 13-year-old son of the, I think turning 14, a 13-year-old son of the Shamash. And he had actually been interrogated fairly early in the procedure by the police and the judge. And then sequestered for over a year at the home of this police sergeant. One doesn't know how much psychological pressure he was under, but he was separated from his family and he had no contact. And in the end, he claimed that he had witnessed the abduction of Esther Shoymoshi and her ritual slaughtering in the courtyard of the shul of the local synagogue. So he was a crucial eyewitness. And it's under these circumstances, of course, that that the father and others are challenging his testimony in court. And some of it is really very moving. The father says, "Tell me, are you davening? Are you wearing your Arba Kanfos?" You know, and the boy at this time decides to take a very defiant attitude towards his father and saying, "Well, you know, I don't need to wear funny costumes. I don't need any of this nonsense." And there was another case where the boy in the end was using Hungarian linguistic terms that the other defendants were convinced he really didn't understand, and they would actually insult him in open court, saying, "Oh, so now you're speaking this fancy Hungarian, not Yiddish, you know, or and so why don't you say the words that you think you know?" But in the end, the reason the boy's testimony was disqualified was very just very Columbo-like, you know, just some simple detective gum work. The defense attorneys said that in order to establish the veracity of the child's testimony, we need to go to Tiso Eslar, to the so-called scene of the crime, and to see if we can corroborate his eyewitness statements. And they brought him to the synagogue and to the door outside the entryway, the courtyard, to the keyhole that he said he had bent down and looked through, and it was clear at that point that you couldn't see anything through that keyhole. It was totally blocked. So it was very simple kind of thing, not very scientific, but that in the end, disqualified all of his testimony. By this time, even the state's prosecutor had decided that there was no case, and the prosecutor himself joined the defense attorney in urging or even instructing the three-judge panel to find the defendants not guilty, which they did. And it was afterwards, by the way, it was after the not guilty verdict that the rioting took place, especially in Budapest and other places. So that's one example of how these cases were both contested and played out. There wouldn't be any other instances of entire Jewish populations standing trial. They would appear much more familiar to us as modern criminal trials that involve one defendant and one victim, and much clearer in terms of both the scientific evidence that's the forensic evidence that collected and the scientific methods and the argumentation. Let me just say, add, if I might, I don't want to talk too much without questions, but in the first two trials, Tiso Eslar and then the first German trial, Xanten, those occur between 1882 and 1892. So there's that one decade. What's distinctive about those two trials is that in both cases, the prosecutors end up subverting their case. They end up arguing for acquittal. And that's in part because they think that the scientific case, it just breaks down. And so you cannot convict these people. Interesting, right? And that's earlier. Now, the later you get to 1900, the harder that is, that it's more difficult for that kind of an outcome to take place. And so in the Hilsner case in Bohemia, tried first in 1899 and then again in 1900, the prosecutor does not switch sides, as it were. And the prosecutor remains consistent in arguing his case. And indeed, in these are jury trials, as is the Xanten case. But in these cases, state stays firm, and Hilsner is convicted twice and sentenced twice.
And we'll get to that. I do want to just jump back still on the Tiso Eslar case. You mentioned Scharf, the father, and the son. I want to point out that, I'll read a little bit from the book. I mean, it's just because it really got me reading it, and where the boy, the son, was giving his testimony. And then you say the father jumps up and he asks if the son is reading a text that he written. And the father says, "I humbly request of the honor of court, I cannot remain silent if my son seeks to destroy me." And then there's back and forth. But the part I think that grabbed me was when, you write down the testimony about each one, that the father says, "Come stand beside me and look me in the face as though I were not the grotesque figure you have made me out to be." The judge asks the boy, "Don't allow yourself to become confused. Answer what you know, do not answer what you don't know." So he said, "I know that no one harmed me." And the father had said that he was forced and kind of tortured. Yeah. So then the father asked him, "I asked you what the fifth commandment was." So he says, "Thou shalt not take the name of God in vain." Like he's the same. Yeah. And he tells him, "That is not. How do you know the Ten Commandments?" This is a father yelling at his son. He says, "When I know the Bible, then I'll know them." Insinuating the father doesn't do it. The father tells him back, "You have studied the Bible. I spent 44 and some years teaching. I brought lunch to you in school myself, so you would not have to go home, but would learn. So tell me, does it say either honor thy father and mother?" And then the best part is, then the judge says, "That is not the fifth commandment either. And you wrote lively laughed in the audience," which it is. Keep it up. Right. But in the Catholics, it's not. So it's
hilarious, game. Right? Yeah. It's like a comedy in a sense, but it's also tragic. But the whole courtroom cracks up because when the father says the fifth commandment, down to your father and mother, and the judge says, "Well, that's not the fifth commandment." Right.
Yeah, that was. So just one thing before we move on to Xanten was, Why? I mean, it kind of sounds like, you know, the judge especially was pushing this narrative. They had this narrative. The Jews did this ritual murder, and they're just going to, they were going to get that in there anyway.
The investigating judge, right? Not the investigating judge.
But the question is, so why, we'll get to the other cases where there is some sort of, you know, slit, and there is some sort of things to the body that would make sense. Here, there was no body originally. Then they find the body, and there was no physical harm to the body. So why did they decide here? Why was there this kind of, oh, this was ritual murder, this is what the Jews did?
Yeah, so the that's a good question. In other words, why do you have, in this case, it looks like at least part of the state's team in the form of this young investigating judge, why does he push so aggressively for a Jewish crime here, especially in the weeks preceding the even discovery of a body? One doesn't even know. And I suppose that there are there are a number of reasons. First of all, the judge himself, Yosef Budde, is young, ambitious. This is one of his first cases. And it may well be that he was convinced or he sensed that this could be a stepping stone to career advancement. That's one possibility. He wrote an autobiographical, a memoir of this case, as did the lead defense attorney named Josef Ertwirsch, also wrote a very popular memoir of the case. And Budde argued that he was not an anti-Semite, and he did not believe that most Jews or Jews by and large commit ritual murders. His argument was that there is a fanatical sect, or there are fanatics among the Jews who are deluded somehow into thinking that Jewish law or custom requires them to behave in this way. So he saw himself still more or less in the, you might say, the liberal camp or the non-anti-Semitic camp. But there was other testimony that had to be taken into consideration. You might remember that there is another dramatic encounter that takes place very early in the affair when the girl's mother and her aunt walk down. It's like a couple of days after the disappearance of Esther, and they walk into a largely Jewish part of Tisa Eslar, where they confront, or they're greeted by Sharf's wife. And then who says, you know, what's the matter? What's going on? And they said, well, it's Esther. She's disappeared. And and then the wife says to the husband, Yosef Sharf, he says, this is so-and-so. And this is Esther Shomashi's mother, Maria, I think was her name. And apparently Esther's gone missing. So you can see that it's a very small town, a very small village where everyone knows everyone, at least they're on a more or less first name basis. And he says, and he makes the decision to say to her, which he came to regret severely. He said, oh, don't worry, don't worry. She's going to turn up. I know it. This happened. My mother said that this one happened in her village in Haidu Nanash, where some boy went missing, and they searched everywhere, including in the ovens in people's homes, and he turned up safe and sound in a field, right? He then came into his home. This is on Shabbat afternoon. He came to his home and he said, you know, this is bad. Something, whatever happens here, whatever comes of this, it's not going to be good. And the mother, in fact, she went to a neighboring sheriff to have an exam, to have the Jewish quarter examined, because she said when Sharf said that to her, she thought that he was making an admission that in fact the Jews had done something so that the, and then she became convinced that that the Jews were involved. In fact, this sheriff followed traditional European patterns at this time and sent her home and said, "Don't bother me. This is nonsense. Don't bother me. This is foolishness. You know, come back when you actually have something." And then it was at that time that a number of village women ingratiated themselves into the company of little Moritz Scharf and his 5-year-old brother, Shmuel or Shamu Scharf. And it was the 5-year-old who, in the end, supposedly testified that the father and his compatriots had killed Esther. They could never get the testimony of a 5-year-old admitted in court. But the but then they began to cultivate Moritz, and this is when he was also separated from the family. Eventually, the mother, the aunt, and some of the other villagers, if as it were, as I sometimes say, they learned the rules of the game. They weren't that you can't just have suspicions. You have to understand what constitutes testimony, what constitutes witness statements, et cetera. And then you might be able to get the state to act. And indeed, they did. So there, again, weeks before the body actually washes to the shore, there are elements in the vicinity of Tisza Eslar, including this judge magistrate buddy and his and the local physicians who are building a case for a Jewish crime. That means everything depends on who that body is. Who has risen, and how do you determine that, right?
Yep, absolutely. So let's move on to the next case. Let's move on to Xanten a little bit. Obviously, we have to discuss more of Hilsner because we've teased that a bunch. So Xanten is different because it's a little boy and kind of almost like the classic trope.
More like the classic. In fact, we might ask ourselves, why are the victims now mainly adolescent and young women? What's going on here, right? They couldn't be stand-ins for Jesus, right? It's different. Yeah, but here, little Johann Hegmann is a 5-year-old boy.
And here we find him, you know, quote unquote, the ritual, you know, ritually slaughtered. So they find him with, his neck sliced and there's blood everywhere. So they here kind of the ritual murder accusation kind of fits, quote unquote. I mean, it at least makes sense for them to accuse it in some sense for their accusation, as crazy as the accusation is, of course, but as opposed to, like we just mentioned, in Tisza Eslar, where there was nothing. It was just like pushing a narrative. Here, it's a little different. So talk about this case a little bit.
Yeah, so here, there are elements, as you suggest, that are closer to the classic accusation. The fact that the victim is a young boy. In my trials, this is the only one in which it's a young boy, actually. And that his throat is slashed. And now, interestingly, you get all sorts of kind of expert assessments, like, what kind of a, is this a Jewish crime or not a Jewish crime? And how would you know that? So one of the apparent signs that it might be a Jewish crime is if the cut in question is that of a shoyfet. Is it a shoyfet's cut from an animal, a cow, for example? How do you determine that? And so in this case, one of the local townspeople, who himself was a butcher, but a Christian butcher, looked at it and he said, "Oh yeah, that's a ritual, it's a Jewish shochet's cut. I know because I'm a butcher, right? And I've seen it." So do you look for a butcher? And in fact, around this time in the 1880s, 1890s, some of the popular understanding of the ritual murder accusation in its more grotesque forms sees it almost as an offshoot of Jewish ritual slaughtering, of Shechita. There is the sense that Shechita is a particularly cruel form of slaughtering, and that and of course that the ritual murder is a cruel infliction of pain and suffering on innocent Christian victims by Jews. Another popular understanding is that you need a shoichet to carry out a ritual murder because that the shoichet knows how to do it, right? And but you got to hand it to the German investigators, right? There's something about being a stickler for rules and procedures. What do they do? They actually send the autopsy report to the medical faculty in Germany, and the medical faculty then looks for expert testimony about the nature of Shechita. So how does a shoiches cut work? How what does it look like? How deep does it go? What kind of a knife has to be used? And they conclude that it's not a shoiches cut. It's that scientific testimony actually is an important element in convincing the prosecutor to sabotage the case, or I shouldn't use that word perhaps, but to argue in the end for acquittal. That's one of the elements for acquittal. Interesting here in the Xanten case too is the accused, Adolf Buschhoff, who was a stonecutter and a butcher. He is extremely well integrated into his small town environment. There's one point where I map out the walks that he was taking or in and around his town of Xanten the day that the murder occurred and the body was discovered. It was also the day of the yard site of his father. And it was a Catholic religious holiday. So people were off from work for much of the day. And he went to shul in the morning to say Kaddish. And he stops off at a cafe for a drink. On his way home, he comes across a variety of people, of non-Jewish neighbors and friends with whom he had engaged in business transactions, including with one animal dealer who had sold him animals, et cetera. And they came to his house. They talked about some different projects that they had. He let them read the local Berlin newspaper, which he subscribed to, that they didn't have while he had lunch. Then he went off to the tavern with these guys and played skittles, you know, it's like bowling, I think, a kind of a 9-pin or 10-pin. And it was while they were playing skittles that the news came of the discovery of the boy's body. He was just totally integrated into his environment, totally at home, knew everybody. Interacted with everybody, was well respected. In fact, the local priest testified as a character witness for him in the trial. So, and that this it brings me sort of to the early boring parts of the book, which were one of the things that I try to argue is that you don't have to posit bad relations between Jews and their non-Jewish neighbors in order to get an accusation of ritual murder. In fact, people can be extremely well integrated into their environment and on relatively good terms with no pre-existing conflict or crisis to take shape. And this is one great example of that. Of course, it didn't help in the end. They burned his house down and damaged the synagogue. And basically, this small town, which was already losing its Jewish population just from migration to the big city, that whole process just accelerated. And Bushoff and his family moved to Cologne nearby.
So you do kind of get that pogrom-like element, that vandalism, even though there is trials and things. And interesting also in this case where they find the blood in his basement. He says it's ox blood, and then they don't believe him, and they send it out for testing.
It's ox blood.
Yeah, it goes back for chemical analysis. This is really modern. And
that's why I'm saying, right? You got to have
if this is a couple hundred years before. I mean, that's the child's blood.
Yeah. What if it was 50 years before? Killed. Yeah, even 50 years, right? I mean, I'm not sure when it was that chemical testing could tell the difference between animal blood and human blood. I don't know when that occurred, but clearly by this time, it's all feasible. Of course, if one had DNA analysis in those days, in the 1890s, it also might have been good. Hilsner?
Yeah, we have to get to Hilsner.
Gotta go to Hilsner.
Now, the Hilsner is, there is some background here. I don't know how much you have to do for the podcast or leave for those interested in reading the book about Prague and what's going on in the Czech or, you know, it's Austria, but what's going on there in the background, like the context in the area leading up to the Hilsner case and trial.
How much background do you think I should, do I think I need to provide? Well, in terms of, it's perhaps a good idea to know something about how Jews were brought into, let's use that term, state and society over the course of the 19th century. Beginning in the late 18th century, under the reign of the enlightened Habsburg monarch Joseph II, 1780s, and then even afterwards, in which the state decided to take an active interest in transforming its large population in Prague and Bohemia and other parts of the monarchy into something else, something other than what they had been. So what had they been? Well, they had been autonomous or semi-autonomous. They had their own courts, they had their own administration, they had their own tax collecting, they had their own hospitals, and much of the legal processes that took place in the Jewish community were organized by halacha. They had their own schools. They spoke a version of Western Yiddish, which is, I think most linguists would argue now that it is indeed Yiddish, but very close to German, close to what you might call Judeo-German or Judendeutsch. And Joseph and his advisors are very keen on ending the this kind of exclusive, separate, pre-modern Jewish status and of merging Jewish society, not completely, but more fully into state and society. So whereas Jews were still barred from some occupations and they were not allowed to own rural property, and indeed there were still cities and towns in Bohemia and Moravia which did not allow Jewish settlement. Nevertheless, they were transformed in important ways, educationally through the establishment of a new modern Jewish German German language Jewish school system, the so-called German Jewish schools of Bohemia and Moravia, which went a long way towards transforming the linguistic behavior of Bohemian and Moravian Jews, and also in creating the image of Jews in this part of the world as Germans, or pro-German, or more German than something else, right? But with the I should say that as we get later into the 19th century, with the rise of a competing, rising Czech-speaking middle class and competition for power between Czech speakers and German speakers, between Czech entrepreneurs and industrialists and the rise in a rising German industrialists and entrepreneurs and a rising Czech middle class, this position of Jews seems to be somehow wrong, right? Or unbalanced, unnatural. Like, why? And Jews were oftentimes in Czech, from a Czech national perspective, Jews were seen as being contributing to German national hegemony in the Czech lands. And but the truth of the matter is that outside of places like Prague, in the countryside, where more than half of the Jews lived at this time, Jews lived in very small settlements, a small minority within a larger non-Jewish society, which was Czech-speaking. And so the vast majority of Jews in Bohemia, at least, if not Moravia, were bilingual or multilingual, and they spoke they went to Czech schools, they spoke Czech in the street, they spoke Czech in business economic pursuits. They would often speak German at home, and especially German in shul, because German had this kind of Jontiftika like quality to it. And so it's in this, and there's a real contest in the late 19th century for Jewish allegiance and pressure on Jews to give up some of their German-centered cultural and political perspective. This is one of the pressures that helps to create, that helps many Jews, especially students, academics, and professionals, to say, okay, you know what? I'm not German and I'm not Czech. I'm Jewish. This is a multinational empire, right? Made up of various nationalities. Why shouldn't I in the 1890s and or early 1900s? Why should I not be Jewish? Why should I be nationally Jewish? This is the time of the first Zionist Congress in 1897. This is the time of when Ahad Ha'am's writings on cultural Zionism becoming very popular. Martin Buber from Galicia comes, and Vienna comes to Prague and gives lectures on sort of how do you reimagine and recreate a living Judaism in a post-Enlightenment, post-secular world. And even people like Franz Kafka, the writer Franz Kafka, his closest friends are all part of the Zionist group. So this is the larger political context in which the Hilsner affair impolitely impinges on this effort to find your place somewhere among Czechs and Germans and to express your Jewishness somehow, right? Again, we have an older or an adolescent, post-adolescent Christian woman, Anezhka Hruzova. Her body is found quickly in the woods outside of the town of Polná, between Polná and the village where she lived, which was called it's the Březina Woods. And is that the name of the village? I think it's the name of the village as well. She was also violently attacked. Her neck was slit. It wasn't the only wound on her body. There were also wounds to her head, and there's blood everywhere. The body is half naked when it's discovered, and then that raises the question: is this a sexual crime or a non-sexual crime? And how do you decide? Right? How do you determine this? So you can imagine what kinds of autopsies they had to perform here. There will be dueling physicians. Most dramatically, the individual who will become, after 1918, the first president of independent Czechoslovakia, Tomáš Masaryk, he decides against all of his personal interests and all of the security of his family and his job as a professor at the Czech University in Prague to intervene in this case and to study the whole forensic record and to argue against the first verdict against Hilsner, to insist on a retrial and to argue really most forcefully against any inclination, any temptation on the part of his fellow Czech nationalists to abide by what he thought was a dangerous and Catholic superstition of the ritual murder case. And he suffered for it. You know, students at the Czech University boycotted his classes and physically prevented him from teaching for a while. He had to send his wife and daughter out of the country. They went to England for a period of time. And he thought, okay, these ruffians won't let me teach. He was extremely stubborn. He actually wrote on the board, he would say, explain to me why you are doing this, or what do you think I'm saying that's unpatriotic or against Czech national interests. He just refused. And then he went to the administration, to his dean, and said, "I fully anticipate now that you're going to defend me. Right? You're going to remove these people and defend my right to teach." And they said, "Well, maybe we think it might be good to take a 2-week leave of absence." So they didn't really defend him at all as well. They're also, it was largely through his intervention in the Hilsner case that he gained the everlasting and eternal admiration of the Jewish people. You know, that so much so that he struck up a very close friendship with the Prague Zionist group. These folks lent him a translation of Achad Ha'am's Al Parshat Rachim in the German translation, Am Scheideweg, to read. So he knew a lot about cultural Zionism. A kibbutz in Palestine was named in his honor, Kfar Masaryk, which exists to this day. So he really became a kind of folk hero to Jews, which probably did not endear him anymore to the anti-Semites in both either German or Czech in the Bohemian lands. This is also Hilsner had at his disposal a very adept defense attorney who was Catholic but married to a Jewish woman. And his name was he had this very difficult last name of Alzhednicek. And his confrontations with the state, with the medical experts and witnesses for the state are also quite dramatic. And I quote rather extensively from some of them, just so you can see how scientific conclusions and processes played such a central role in determining the outcome of these cases. One could read from those as well. They're very dramatic. Like, anyway. But poor Hilsner, his jury was simply not sympathetic. And was he convicted in part because the political atmosphere in the Bohemian lands around 1900 was so bad or so conflict-ridden? It's possible, I think. It's possible. Also, the family of the victim had as their private attorney a man named Baksa, Karel Baksa, who brought up the blood libel right from the start. And even when the judge kept saying, "We're not interested in this, don't bring this up," he was doing that. Now, Baksa, interestingly, after 1918, became the mayor of Prague, and he was the longtime mayor of Prague. So he clearly got along when he wanted to with the Jewish population of the city. This was Prague is one of those cities in Central Europe which, except for a very short period of time, never had a major expulsion of its Jewish population. It did for a period under Maria Theresa. But unlike almost every other city in Central Europe, except for Frankfurt, Prague had this almost continuous Jewish population. It's one of the reasons why in the 18th century, it was perhaps the second largest Jewish community in Europe outside of Amsterdam. Salonika also was bigger. I'm not sure when it becomes bigger. But Salonika as one of those havens for Spanish and Portuguese Jews, it has just an enormous population, Jewish population. So, what else?
Yeah, well, so Hilsner's just, so unique. As you say, there's a lot more to, you relay in, you in the book, you quote from the trial transcript.
Trial transcript.
And yes, and it's really interesting. So, I'll leave that again for those interested. Yeah, I think I mentioned this, but I'll put a link in the show's notes for those interested to compare.
Yeah, let them see the book and where they can get it.
Exactly, you can read the book. But I will say, but Hilsner is unique in that he is found guilty. And sentenced to death twice. And so just why does that happen? And what happens to him also? What ends up happening to him? He doesn't actually, spoiler alert, he doesn't get killed, though, even though he sentenced to death. He doesn't.
He does change his name. changes it to Heller. Well, I mean, if you left prison in 1916 with two death sentences over you and you settle in Vienna, you might change your name to Heller too. Right? But so Hilsner is interesting fellow in so many respects. He was a sort of a ne'er-do-well. He was a kind of a ruffian. Not the kind of young man that the Jewish community of Poland would necessarily have been proud of in any event. He tended to hang out mainly with non-Jewish friends, and he was one of those, a great example of a Jew who's fully at home in Czech as well as German, because all of his friends were Czech speakers, and yet he grew up or lived in a caretaker's apartment attached to the synagogue, because his mother, with whom there's no father around as far as I know, his mother was impoverished and basically taken care of through communal charity. So he was always around the shul. How often he went to shul, I can't say, but he grew up there. In that sense, it's very different than the kinds of people who typically were accused of Jewish ritual murder. They tended to be, as I think we touched upon before, they tended to be somehow knowledgeable, right? They were quasi-experts in Jewish custom and law, oftentimes shochtim, although not always. They could be shamashim, they could be shochtim, almost never rabbis by this period. That's interesting too. But Hilsner is really the outsider. He's on the margins. He's a marginal man. And it may have been also his generally unsavory personality that also helped to sway the jury in these cases, right? We should come to expect that, even just looking at our own judicial system. But he did have good representation. And here, too, we can see these as larger Jewish stories. You know, anti-Semites complained in Hungary that the powerful Budapest Jews were trying to control the narrative, and they were intervening in the Hungarian case. Well, you know what? They did, in a certain sense, that it was money from the Jewish community of Budapest that paid for the defense team of the Tisza Eszler Jews. And Auschwitznicek in Prague was technically a pro bono appointment, but he volunteered to take that case. And I think he also received support from the Jewish Alliance in Vienna. So Vienna Jews, Prague Jews, Budapest Jews, they were involved. But these were cases where, Jews were arrivim zelazeh. They were responsible for one another. And Jews mobilized politically to defend their co-religionists. I guess this is something you first see in the Damascus case. Wonderful book by Jonathan Frankel on Damascus, when Adolf Cremieux in France and Moses Montefiore in England joined forces to travel all the way to Alexandria and to Damascus, really, and then eventually to Constantinople to negotiate for the Damascus defendants. Some have argued that Damascus really begins international Jewish politics. The Alliance Israelite Universelle, a kind of Shtadlanut that's much more geared to modern politics and modern tactics, and that now goes right through the last of our cases, and certainly in Bayless as well.
So the last case, as you term it, the many trials of Konitz, in some ways, reading this, this was like the weirdest case. I mean, it's an 18-year-old guy, first of all. He's a tall, strapping youth. You know, he's really an adolescent. He's almost an adult. It's Ernest.
Who could even beat him up?
And he's found just, he's hardly found. They find his torso. Then they find, a few months later, a hand. Another few months later, another
hand. A leg and a head.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry for the listeners if we've been like gruesome and grotesque, but this is just absolutely gruesome. They find body parts everywhere throughout the town
over time.
They find his clothing. I mean, this is just crazy. And then they come up with, oh, ritual murder. This is also just weird, the connection between the two, and that it's this older guy as opposed to like other one either being a child or, a female or, you know. So what do you, talk a little bit about this case, because I just found this case to be.
Yeah, that's true. In this case, the victim is a man named Winter, who is an 18-year-old gymnasium student. He's even old. He's even older than his classmates in the gymnasium, because he starts a little bit late. And he's very handsome. He's a man about town. He seems to be dating everybody and the wives of some of the town fathers. And he fails to return home after a Sunday dinner at the place where he is a lodger as this advanced gymnasium student. A few days later, some body parts of his are float up in the lake in town, and it takes a while for other body parts to appear. They do so in a rather teasing manner over time. Some people begin to argue that it's that the culprit is Adolf Levy, who was a rather older, middle-aged butcher, of course. But the police, in the end, really, he seems to have a pretty solid alibi. I think he was even out of town on that day. And they don't take that particularly seriously. But they're not quite sure whom to take. And of course, there is testimony again by supposed eyewitnesses. But this testimony is questioned and taken apart and investigated. And even those who offer the testimony are themselves the subject of investigation. And let me also mention that another suspect is a Christian butcher whose property is next door to the Jewish butcher, but also extends all the way down to the lake and abuts that lake where the body parts first appeared. Beyond that, he also had a teenage daughter, and it's possible that he had surprised the daughter and Ernst Winter in flagrante delicto at a certain point after Sunday dinner, and lost his temper, right? So it's possible, all these things are possible, but there are a number of aspects of this case that are similar and fall into pattern with everything we've been looking at. As in all of the German cases, the professional civil service takes their jobs very seriously. They have a real sense of vocation, adherence to technique and law, devotion to the scientific methodology, etc. The medical faculties, they always go to the elite medical faculty that's next door, in this case from Danzig, and try and get expert opinions here. But beyond that, this is a case in which it looks like the state is simply has lost its nerve, doesn't know exactly how to proceed. There's too many loose ends, too many competing theories of the case and competing evidence and interpretations of evidence. In the end, they manage to have five trials, but they end up adding up to less than a good murder trial. There's one for a poor Jewish used clothing dealer named Wolf Israelski, who was charged with aiding and abetting because someone claimed to have seen him dragging a sack with what looked like maybe a body in it on the day before the body's parts were discovered. Then there were a number of individuals who were tried separate on separate occasions for perjury, including the state's prize witnesses, Bernhard Maslow and Anna Ross, who claimed to have seen something like the murder itself from the basement of Adolf Levy. They were, for their troubles, they were put on trial for perjury by the state. Shows you that the state was serious. But also the son of this Adolf Levy had his own perjury trial in 1901. Why? Because he claimed that he never had met Ernst Winter. He didn't know him. And yet there were other gymnasium students and a small assortment of individuals who claimed that they had seen Winter and Moritz Levy talking to each other in the street. And so there's so many questions that arise here. First of all, what did it mean that Moritz Levy might have known the victim? Does that make him any more likely as a suspect in his murder? It's not clear. If he did know him, why would he have committed perjury? He never ever strayed from his claim not to have known Winter. And in that chapter, I also look at some efforts by German detectives, including even after World War II, to go over this record and to see to assess it forensically, and to try to explain why Moritz Levy might have insisted that he didn't know him. And in my view, I think he never changed his story. Why? Because he didn't know him. In fact, he simply didn't know him. And indeed the gymnasium, Winter's own gymnasium teacher, or maybe it was also Moritz Levy. Levy had graduated from the same gymnasium. He said they did not know each other. At one point I thought, well, maybe if Levy was denying this relationship, it was because were they perhaps gay and they had had some relationship, and he would, for him, it was worse to admit, it was better to be convicted of perjury than to admit that he knew him. But I don't think in the end that was true. I think our poor victim, Ernst Winter, was definitely a ladies' man, and that there was no relationship between the other two. But what really happens is simply that in the end, by this time, the states, they have no case, and they want to wash their hands of it. In the end, they just want to wash their hands of it. There's nothing to be done. And they never try the Christian butcher, whom I think he was probably the villain. Because in the end, the last scientific autopsy on Winter makes pretty clear that he had been engaged in some kind of a sexual act, either while he was being killed or immediately, just at the end. He was like covered in semen.
So, I mean, this is just a very interesting case, as you've relayed. And then, I mean, this kind of, there's a little gap after this. This brings us to Bayless. I mean, how does Bayless connect? Like you said, this Bayless is not something you discuss. I don't know if that's because it's just been discussed elsewhere so much.
There are two new books on the Bayless case. Plus, I don't read Russian sources. You know, for this book, I had to read reports, trial transcripts, newspaper accounts, etc. in German, Czech, Hungarian, French, Hebrew, some Yiddish, English, if I was lucky and on vacation. But But I don't read Yiddish. I didn't want to learn Russian for this project. Although I did study Hungarian just for this book. But it's true. But there are also the two excellent books that one by Robert Weinberg and one by Edmund Levin that have just come out in the last 2 years on the Bayless case. Bayless is, I think in the end, Bayless more or less accords with this general pattern, with some exceptions. The Russian legal system, criminal legal system, was different than the Western system, although it was a reformed criminal justice system. So there were juries. It was not it was not inquisitorial examination system, but rather trial on modern trial with prosecutors and defenders and witnesses and challenging of witnesses, etc. This was a case in which there was a tremendous amount of interference from a variety of sources, from the Ministry of Justice, from the Ministry of Interior, even from the Tsar's officers in St. Petersburg. Way too many people were interested in this case. In the end, the state lost. It lost its case because it asked the jurors two questions, which was already strange. It first asked whether Menachem Mendel Bayless was guilty of having killed Andrei Yushchinsky, of having committed the murder. And he was acquitted on that charge. But the state wanted to have its cake and eat it too, and it wanted to nevertheless assert that this murder bore the markings of a ritual crime, that it wasn't a simple murder. So it asked that second question. Was the murder of Andrei Yushchinsky a ritual crime? It's hard to say what that means. Oh, they said that there were, I don't know, that the markings on the body pointed to some kind of a language, that the blood was drained from the body, etc. And they answered in the affirmative. And there is a, I don't know if this is true or not, but there is a story going that went around that the Tsar himself had commented on the case that he's glad that Bayless was acquitted because he was innocent, but the Yids are guilty. Actually, he used the term probably less polite than Yids in talking about that. Remember, keep in mind when this is, 1911 to 1913, the eve of the First World War, tremendous political pressure on the empire, on the Tsarist system. The Tsarist empire will not survive the First World War, right? The Russian Revolution will take place 4 years later. And this is a period also by this time, after 1905, and certainly around the time of the Bayless case, the Tsarist government is willing to use mobilized anti-Semitism in order to try to stay in power. You know that there was a historiographical argument about the earlier pogroms in Russia, 1881, 1882, the first wave of pogroms, then Kishinev, 1903, which was also related to a ritual murder accusation, by the way, 1905, et cetera, that the state promoted, or at least at best stood by while these violent actions were, these riots were taking place. And all of the recent historiography has shown that that's not true, that they actually were mortified. They were scared to death by these this uncontrolled popular action. They were afraid that it would result in revolution. But by the time you get to the World War, the period just before the First World War, and especially in afterwards, the government is actually using now pogrom and anti-Semitism in order to stay in power. But it's late; happens late. So in the end, I think Bayless is kind of weird. It points back to very traditional religious motifs and traditional anti-Semitism, but in the end also the case fails.
Yeah, only Hilsner is somewhat successful, and even then he's sentenced to, instead of the death sentence, they end up saying go to jail, and then he ends up getting out later. But
he's pardoned in 1916 during the war. Yeah.
Okay.
But so the last Habsburg emperor.
The question here, just the last question, yeah, after all this long episode, whoever's left listening is, aside from being an interesting story, there are many, like I said, fascinating. Some of these stories, you actually read them in the book as you recount them. It's a thriller. They're a mystery. They're unfortunate. And they're just interesting. But what can someone today take out of this? Why should someone today care, other than it being a nice historical, or is it just that, just an, a nice, historical, yeah, not nice, but you get the point.
Well, I think one thing that I hope people will come away from the book with is a different attitude toward what they might otherwise simply dismiss out of hand as crazy or ridiculous or just another thing that the Goyim say about the Jews. And ask themselves harder questions like, is there some kind of a structure of plausibility within the larger culture that makes these things work? Why do they work? How do they work? What makes them believable? What makes them plausible or might? And analytical attitude, I think, can surpasses Jewish history, the bounds of Jewish history, and even the bounds of Jewish Christian relations over time, to understand a lot of the conspiracy theories, for example, that are making their way and in this day, in this age of streaming and of not podcasts, which are some podcasts are really, careful and well structured and analytical, but I mean, there's so many websites and there's so many sources of opinion. There's so much transmission of words of knowledge today that I think we have to have a different discipline of trying to understand how these things work. What makes a conspiracy theory attractive? What makes it work within a given culture? That's one. And so I think that I hope people will begin to look at that. There's also the relationship between authority, scientific authority, and other kinds of moral authorities and popular belief. Ironically, much more deference was shown towards academic and scientific authority in 1900 than it is in 2023. And you could see that especially during during the COVID pandemic, where it was precisely the scientists somehow who were misleading us or feeding us misinformation or trying actually to harm us. So one might want to ask the question, well, whatever happened to science or scientific prestige or scientific authority? And I think that we have to understand that we actually, and as a cultural moment, we're standing at a very different point than they were in 1900 and 1910. And ironically, at a point where people, so it seems, accord less deference that they and recognize less legitimacy, less deference and less legitimacy to scientific authority or cultural authority generally than we did in, say, in 100 years ago, right? I would be interested to know why. Like, why? Is it just because there's too much information out there? Too much. There's just too much information. Or is it because, in a sense, our culture is too democratic? By democratic, I mean anything goes, or everybody's opinion is as good as anybody else's opinion. What is it exactly? There are questions in that relate to Jewish security, to Jewish society, and to Jewish non-Jewish interactions that are worth looking at. Like, are Jews still fair game for conspiracy theories of all types or any types? And what seem to be the ones that are really catching on or that seem to have most traction nowadays? And then I would say, now don't just look at these and say, it's the stupid non-Jews who will believe anything, but ask yourself, how do they work? What are the arguments based on? What are they jumping off of or bouncing off of in terms of current trends and popular beliefs or in assumptions? What's new? What's traditional? What's new? Does the relatively successful position of Jews in American society, is that a liability in terms of these kinds of theories? Does the Israeli-Palestinian controversy exacerbate international anti-Semitism, or is it the solution to, is Israel the solution to international anti-Semitism? These are difficult questions, but I think they're worth looking at carefully.
So, you know, it's as you're saying, while this book is about blood libel and ritual murder, and that's why this episode is being posted around Pesach time, this is, you know, when historically you've had accusations of ritual murder and blood libel against the Jews, and as, I don't know if all of them, most of these cases that we've been discussing on this episode and in the book do take place, it's not only about that. As you're laying out, and then someone can take up from the book. So I will link to the book in the show's notes for those interested in purchasing it and reading through it. And as I said, the cases itself. I don't mean to say this point at the beginning is boring. It's not, but it's more of like more academic, I guess. I'll say this for the listeners that do read the book. Skipping to chapter 2 and reading through there is just a wonderful read. I will say as
make sure you do 2 through 5 and the conclusion.
Yes, and that's not to put down the beginning. Yeah. I just think that if you do that, you'll get it's a really, again, unfortunate but thrilling read, and there's just a lot there to see and take in. And so, thank you, Professor Keevil, for joining me.
You're very welcome. Happy to do it.